Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
A newly drafted United States nuclear strategy that has been sent to President Trump for approval would permit an expanded use of nuclear weapons. This document is called the Nuclear Posture Review. The following is a 30-minute excerpt from an interview on the issue of nuclear weapons. The program was recorded 1 week ago in the studios of Radio Sputnik here in Washington, D.C. with Greg Mello. He is the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, and with Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog of the organization Beyond Nuclear. Greg Mello, welcome to Washington, D.C. What brings you here?
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here. Well, I'm here to prevent the construction of a new Rocky Flats plant, which would enable the acquisition of new kinds of nuclear weapons in the U.S. arsenal and be a threat to world peace. So that's what I'm doing.
And are you hopeful?
Medium. There's quite a few people in Washington who have been around long enough to treat with skepticism the so-called requirements to produce new nuclear weapons and the cores of nuclear weapons. This is what we're talking about. They're little atomic bombs, and maybe not so little. And they're hard to make, and they are in some ways the critical step in making new kinds of nuclear weapons. And the United States has 23,000 of these cores. Some are in deployed weapons, some are in reserve weapons, some are in retired weapons, and some are just in storage. There may be about 16,000 or more pits in storage in Texas.
Is the argument that the Rocky Flats plant is obsolete, it's too old, that it needs renovation for security purposes? Because it would seem on its face that this idea of building newer nuclear facilities with little nuclear bombs, these cores, would be on its face in violation of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Because the idea is, the quid pro quo being that non-nuclear powers are determined not to gain nuclear technologies for nuclear weapons production in exchange for the already existing nuclear powers incrementally getting rid of their nuclear weapons and then ultimately getting rid of all of their nuclear weapons.
Isn't that the whole idea behind the NPT?
Exactly. But the NPT is not really followed here in the U.S. or the other nuclear weapon states. They think the NPT is just for non-nuclear weapon states. So the uncertainty. So Rocky Flats plant closed. Well, it closed partially in 1989 with a raid by the EPA and FBI. They were in massive violation of environmental laws. And
in fact, there were criminal charges that came out of that, weren't there?
There were, but I don't know. Nothing was ever
right. It wasn't
nobody
resolved.
The Rocky Flats grand jury left very disappointed uh-huh. in how their findings, their evidence was used and what was dropped. And so it all quietly went away. I don't think anybody served any time or anything. And then they finally closed the plant after trying to restart it in 92. And it became a cleanup site. And since then, the United States has not had an industrial level plutonium warhead core factory. Russia has such, and the reason we don't is partly because the sacrifice made by the time Rocky Flats closed, the standard of craft there was very high. The workers sacrificed themselves basically to produce very, quote, high quality nuclear weapon cores, and they last a very long time, a century approximately. And so there's no need to make them. The Russians had a different philosophy of changing the stockpile, keeping the workforce busy. And so they are changing them out all the time because they don't last that long. And so as a result, they have surge capacity, which makes U.S. militarists and generals very nervous. And this disparity has been at the core of the neoconservative idea that we've got to have a big factory.
Okay, Kevin Camps, this week, Iran, President Trump has to decide whether to certify whether Iran is indeed in compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, also known as the Iran Nuclear Arms Deal. President Trump has been insisting that North Korea, which may have 6 nuclear weapons, presents a grave danger to the United States and to world peace. It's interesting what Greg Mello said, that the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, as interpreted by the nuclear powers, is only applied to those that don't have nuclear powers, or that those countries that the nuclear powers don't want to have nuclear weapons. In other words, they're out of compliance.
That was one of my favorite parts of the Nobel Peace Prize award ceremony, was Beatrice Finn and the survivor Setsuko Thurlow from Hiroshima calling out the nuclear weapons powers on their hypocrisy and their essentially violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so it even gets worse than that. Here you have a country, Iran, and I'm no fan of the Iranian regime, but they did have the right under the NPT to develop a so-called Atoms for Peace nuclear power program. And yet countries like Israel and the United States under George W. Bush were threatening war against Iran for pursuing what Iran was claiming was a electricity supply from nuclear power. So here we go again. I mean, the crises are by the hour, by the day with the Trump administration. And President Trump on Friday, I believe it is, will decide whether to certify or decertify Iran's compliance with the nuclear agreement, not just with the United States, but with several countries. And if Trump decertifies, it's going to lead to the United States being in non-compliance with this nuclear agreement. There are major powers that have signed this thing, including Russia, including European countries. And so for the United States to walk away from this thing, it's going to have repercussions, and it's just going to add to conflict and crisis in the Middle East, as if there isn't enough already, with, you know, wars raging in various countries in the Middle East with some of these same players, these essentially vying for power enemies like Saudi Arabia and Iran and others in proxy wars as we speak in various places. And so it's just going to pour more gasoline on the fire.
There's a number of issues here. One is the danger of nuclear war, the danger of nuclear accidents, the danger of a conflict getting out of hand, so that even though no side wants a nuclear confrontation, once people start climbing the escalation ladder, the other side has to have a countermeasure. In some ways, people think, I believe, there's kind of a passivity about the issue of nuclear weapons now compared to, say, the early 1980s, when there was a great, great alarm and Reagan was encircling the Soviet Union with intermediate and tactical nuclear weapons, some of which had a 6-minute flight time to their targets at political offices inside the Soviet Union. A big peace movement grew all over Europe, and it had its component here in the United States. We had a march on June 12th, 1982 of 1 million people in Central Park. But the passivity right now is premised really on the feeling that we're not in danger. There's not going to be a nuclear weapon, that all of that talk was maybe hyperbole, that all is well. Is it well?
Not at all. I mean, there are thousands of nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert between the United States and Russia alone. And I just read Dan Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, where one of his points in his long career as a nuclear war planner was the United States planned to take out the Soviet and then Russian military command and control infrastructure was a pretty unwise thing if you want to stop a small-scale nuclear war from going full-scale. And so, you know, Rebecca Solnit made the point, you just raised the Central Park rally with 1 million people against the nuclear arms race. The mistake that the movement made in the United States was a lot of people kind of went home when the Soviet Union fell apart. Those weapons remained on hair trigger alert. They still do remain on hair trigger alert now. And with the, you know, the tension in the world, North Korea, of course, being the current hotspot, but we just talked about Iran as well. People need to engage. There's a lot at risk. It's you can't overstate what's at risk right now.
Greg Mello, why are the weapons on hair trigger alert? I mean, why? It right. doesn't look like
Serious
we don't
question.
Feel like we're on the edge no. of the
like
apocalypse.
Two minutes to midnight on the nuclear clock or whatever it is. Why? Why are we on alert?
Because the Air Force couldn't really deploy ICBMs if they weren't on alert. They would have no raison d'etre. And so there's a whole group of senators that would oppose getting rid of them. And if there's financial interest, political interest involved, there's not really a strong strategic interest. In fact, it's a negative strategic interest. They're vulnerable to hacking. And this is from General Cartwright, who was head of the Strategic Command and knew what he was talking about. He says, if you think they can't be hacked, you're wrong.
In fact, it was General Cartwright who was able to oversee installation in the Iranian program of the Stuxnet virus.
Correct.
So if General Cartwright can oversee hacking of a system like that, certainly there are others out there who can hack into our system.
Correct. And now we see that there's a vulnerability in all Intel chips.
Literally all.
Yeah. And this should make people worried, and we should be standing down until this is resolved, and then we should get rid of these things. We have William Perry, who was Secretary of Defense, who says they make us less secure, not more. So this is a big opportunity. We should take it. We don't need those things.
In fact, didn't Kim Jong-un say just, what, 2 days ago, Brian? He actually seemed surprised that people thought that North Korea's nuclear weapons were for use against South Korea. And he said that he would never launch a nuclear attack on his Korean brethren. North Korea's nuclear weapons were to protect itself from the United States, which is a hostile power to North Korea and has nuclear weapons.
Well, North Korea was part of the NPT regime. It was a member state of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and subject to intrusive inspections. And then January 2002, George W. Bush, having trashed the Sunshine Policy of Kim Dae-jung, which had led to a thaw and people hoped a normalization of relations between North and South Korea, Bush trashed that. Kim Dae-jung, the South Korean president, came in March 2001 and Bush treated him rudely, et cetera, et cetera. Then September 11th happened, and Bush declared in January 2002, there's an axis of evil, and that axis is Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. And everyone knew who was paying attention that the U.S. was getting ready to go to war against the first part of that axis, and that would be Iraq, which had subjected itself to weapons inspections, had disarmed itself in essence, and thus would be low-hanging fruit for an invasion. And then the North Koreans said, okay, we get it. We're going to leave the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and we're going to get a nuclear weapon because we don't trust you. Because you might say one thing under under Bill Clinton, you know, there was an attempted normalization at the end, but the next guy can come in and turn it all around. So the only thing that can guarantee our security is our own nuclear presence. I mean, since then, things froze. That's why this happened.
An amazing part of the whole history here, you mentioned the Axis for Evil speech. I happened to catch on C-SPAN radio, because you can turn your radio on in the car and get C-SPAN radio in Washington, D.C., and they were interviewing Bush's speechwriter, David Frum, who came up with the phrase Axis of Evil. And what he said in that interview just floored me. He said, yes, Iraq, yes, Iran. And North Korea was added as an afterthought because they didn't want to appear to be anti-Muslim. And you said it.
That's so funny because they added North Korea to the travel ban so it wouldn't look like a Muslim travel ban.
So there's a history here. And, you know,
that's an amazing. I didn't know that.
North Korea's response to that, after seeing what happened in Iraq, you know, with the execution of Saddam Hussein after the invasion, seeing later what happened in Libya with the execution in the street of Muammar Gaddafi, North Korea took some steps, you know, and in 2006, they exploded their first test blast. And so there are consequences to this kind of imperial behavior, essentially.
We've talked about that on this program, as a matter of fact. If you look at Muammar Gaddafi, he did everything right, right? He saw the invasion of Iraq and he said, oh boy, the Americans invaded Iraq because the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction. Whether they did or not was irrelevant. But that was the reason. I better give up my weapons of mass destruction. And so it was Gaddafi who reached out to the CIA and said that he was ready to give up his weapons.
Well, he got busted.
There of course he did.
There was a uranium enrichment facility.
Sure, of course. And everybody knew it.
En route.
Everybody knew it. But a senior CIA officer went to Libya and negotiated the dismantling of the program. And we still turned on him, and he died like an animal in the streets. So that has to be a message to every other world leader who is not on necessarily good terms with the United States and either has or is considering a WMD program. I mean, do you give it up and still risk being overthrown and executed or assassinated? Or do you just maintain the program and take your chances with the Americans?
And it's a part of that history, too, of the United States and other nuclear weapons powers depending on things to this day, decades later, like deterrence. So here's North Korea depending on nuclear deterrence, as the United States has explicitly done for many decades now.
You know, Greg Mello, I can remember reading Michio Kaku, nuclear physicist, his book, To Win a Nuclear War. He co-authored the book. But they had gotten, the authors had gotten classified documents back about the Korean War, the Forgotten War. Some of the documents revealed that the Joint Chiefs of Staff had taken a unanimous decision around April or May of 1953 to begin using nuclear weapons against North Korea and parts of China unless the DPRK and China signed the armistice that would bring the military conflict to an end. This was a decision taken because the North Koreans didn't want to sign it. They wanted to keep fighting. They figured, you know, we've endured the worst. We want to evict the Americans and the others from the southern part of our country. And then perhaps it was China. We don't know. We don't know why, but the armistice was signed about 2 months later. But it appears from those documents that if the armistice had not been signed, the U.S. was prepared to actually carry out the nuclear annihilation of North Korea. Now, the North Koreans know all this. I mean, they didn't need the classified documents. They didn't need to hear that we had read Michio Kaku's book. They know. So when Donald Trump gets up at the podium at the United Nations and says, I'm prepared to totally annihilate you, for the North Koreans, that has not just the ring of a maniacal, maverick, political operative, Donald Trump, but it seems institutionalized, or at least the American government was prepared to do that. Now, North Korea has never been prepared to, quote, totally annihilate the United States, but they certainly have been the recipient of that kind of decision making.
Certainly. And during the Korean War, they were pretty much annihilated. There were almost no conventional targets left, not one stone left on another. The tonnage of bombs was enormous, and there was also mass slaughter of civilians that took place when people were fleeing south because the U.S. forces felt they couldn't discriminate between civilians and soldiers sometimes. So there's a lot of things that have been hushed up about that war.
Let's talk about the evolution of nuclear weapons from the point of view of the geostrategic use of these weapons, not simply to go to war, but also to threaten war, to intimidate. In August 1945, at the time that the bomb was dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the U.S. had a monopoly on nuclear weapons. And so I believe the U.S. felt, you know, we're going to get our way in world politics. The Soviets had just lost 20 or 27 million dead. They didn't have a nuclear weapon. It seemed like the ace in the hole for American post-war plans. The Soviets were obviously rushing to gain their own nuclear capability. And then soon thereafter, the People's Republic of China did the same. But it seemed like in the beginning part of the post-World War II era, the idea that these weapons could be used and used and used again was very operational because they had been used. In other words, there was a feeling that it wasn't a moral or ethical determination not to use them. It was like, we can use them because we can use them. And it was only when the Soviets perhaps developed either nuclear parity or some kind of capacity to hit back that there became an equilibrium about nuclear weapons where there was the mutually assured destruction concept. Now we have the United States. It seems to me, and I could be completely wrong about this. I want to get both of your opinions. Is the United States actually seeking to go back to an era, I can't get rid of the other country's nuclear weapons, but go back to an era where military supremacy is such that nuclear weapons or the use of nuclear weapons actually becomes an operational concept once again? Is that part of the thinking?
For some people, but not a majority of people. I think
that's
that,
good.
Yeah. I think that the process of preparing the Trump nuclear posture review has been one of weeding out crazy ideas gradually, week by week, over the summer and fall last year. And those, I think that type of thinking is not at all dominant. Just a few crazies out there, of course. But And they're, you know, they have a place in this administration, unfortunately, that's bigger than in the previous administration. But there still is a doctrine of compellence along with the doctrine of deterrence. And that is semi-official. So the Defense Science Board has used that phrase actually comes from a report by the Congressional Research Service. But the Defense Science Board has referred to this idea before. And the idea is you threaten and you have nuclear weapons as an kind of an aegis of power over your expeditionary forces so they can't be defeated. So it's like the Air Force uses the analogy of fighters above the bombers, the top cover. So it's the top cover over U.S. expeditionary forces, escalatory control. So the idea is that with this in place, then we can coerce and we can get the political, diplomatic, military outcomes that we want. And that remains very much in place.
And Kevin Camps, let me just go back to you. It's not just Donald Trump. We had the Obama administration also modernizing the nuclear arsenal, a big, expensive modernization. Why would they do that? Is it simply to keep the weapons safe, secure, in other words, not getting too old? Or are they starting to consider battlefield options for nuclear weapons, perhaps of a different type, maybe smaller or lower yield or adjustable yield nuclear weapons? What's the modernization for?
Right. $1 trillion nuclear weapons modernization over 30 years, probably more than that. So, you know, really it comes down to actual new weapons designs with new military applications, which again is another violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty commitments, another escalation. And some of these proposals are very destabilizing. So, for example, a nuclear-tipped cruise missile that an adversary could not tell whether it's conventional or nuclear until it explodes. And so they may make a decision to respond thinking it's nuclear with a nuclear response when it was only a conventional cruise missile. These are the kinds of destabilization activities that the United States is undertaking.
That's crazy. I mean, what's the thinking there?
Well, like Greg said, there are some nuclear hawks who have played roles during the Obama years, now certainly during the Trump years, who get their way sometimes. And the nuclear weapons labs in this country are, and Greg can speak to this more than I can, are a very, very powerful political player in this country. And they demand billions per year. And they want to see that gravy train keep rolling for decades to come.
Yeah, I think we're already seeing, actually, a manifestation of this. There's an article that was just published moments ago by Newsweek saying that the Trump administration is planning to develop a new, what they're calling a low-yield version of the Trident missile. It would be nuclear-tipped, and it would be placed on U.S. submarines to use tactically as a part of normal battles. This is something that was shunned. The very idea was shunned by the Obama administration. But one of President Obama's arms control and proliferation assistants, John Wolfstall, is saying that he's already seen the most recent draft of a new Trump policy review, indicating that the U.S. plans to start developing this small nuclear weapon.
This is consistent with everything that I've heard as well. And I think we can expect this on January 19th. And the unfortunate, well, there's a lot of unfortunate things about that. It's stupid strategically. It's quick to do because it doesn't really require, I think it's pretty quick. You could do it with wire cutters.
Sure.
And so it's, you know, it's stupid because it reveals the location of the Trident submarines when the first one is launched. There's overflight issues. There's all the issues that Kevin brought up of confusing what's actually going on. It looks a lot like a nuclear strike. I mean, like a big nuclear strike, an all-out nuclear war. So, you know, it's crazy. And I guess we have our work cut out for us in fighting this and other things we may see on a week from Friday.
And talk about Friday. Why? Just for the audience that may not be paying attention.
January 19th, we expect the nuclear posture review to be released. Okay. And then we'll have all these ideas in detail, and not just one or two people will have them.
Before we go to a short break, just how does the nuclear posture review take place? What are the different agencies and institutions? How long does it take place? How often does it happen?
I think it's sort of irregular. It involves all the national security actors to one degree or another. It's been an all-year process, headquartered in the Pentagon. Rob Suffer is in charge of it. He used to be John McCain's nuclear weapons person in the Senate, in the committee, Senate Armed Services Committee. And so it's been coordinated among all the agencies.
Go ahead, Kevin.
And that just happens to be the same day that the government either shuts down or doesn't. So the Trump administration...
Can we shut down that part of the government?
At least.
Yeah, before they do the wrong thing.
Yeah. How much has the United States spent on nuclear weapons?
Well, I mean, there's a great book called The Atomic Audit from many years ago. And at that point, the estimate was $7.5 trillion, which is a big fraction of our national debt.
It's more now, both from inflation of that figure and then everything we've done since. So it's really other than the rest of the military, it's really the largest post-World War II expense up to the end of the Cold War. It dwarfs everything else. It was a vast treasure.
It's amazing when you think about it. I mean, it's hard to think about it, actually. It's hard to wrap your head around it. The nuclear era began in 1945, really, in terms of its demonstration, August 1945. We've spent $7.6 trillion before. Now it's, who knows, maybe it's $8 trillion, maybe it's $9 trillion. And a trillion, we don't even know what a trillion is. I mean, it's just too many zeros. And it's for a program that the only time the weapon was used was in August 1945.
Well, actually, Dan Ellsberg made the point in his book, The Doomsday Machine, that the weapons are used all the time. They're used like a gun in the hand of somebody who's robbing a bank. They hope to not have to pull the trigger, but they might.
And there's an identity between those two things, because where they're really pointed is at the American people. They're pointed at the appropriations process. Mm-hmm. There's the fear.
That's a good point.
The fear that's inculcated keeps the money flowing, and not just for nuclear weapons, for the entire military establishment. And so that's... You know, that's really, I think, their primary use.
All right. We have 60 seconds to go before we go to our break. Kevin Kamps, what could we spend? What could we do with $7 trillion? I mean, just think about it. I mean, just think about what we have a situation where one out of every two Americans is either in poverty or close to poverty. Those are the numbers.
That's actual, not just figures.
Yeah. I mean, you have bridges crumbling. You have highways. We don't have adequate trains. I mean,
airports are international embarrassments.
And outside of using nuclear weapons like a gun in the hand of a thief who says, give me your wallet or else, society gets nothing from this.
Well, the American Society of Civil Engineers most recently gave a D+, I think it was, to U.S. infrastructure, which is having some impacts like that train derailment out west recently. So imagine what it could be used for, turning around the climate catastrophe that's at our door. There's another idea.
Yeah. And really, the loyalty to the Pentagon and the myth of national security allows the public debate to be so terribly muted on this. You're listening to Loud and Clear after a very short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.